Hello and welcome to Piece by Piece, the podcast where we piece together what makes a world without violence. While we don't always see it, gender-based violence is all around us. At Anova, we believe in a future without violence. But what does a future without violence look like, and how do we get there? My name is Dr. Annalise Trudell, and I'm your host.
Three perspectives on the Black lived experience. Today's episode, I have the honor of talking with Ro, Vida, and Jayshin on what it means to be Black, past, present, and future. Now, no one experience can represent a full group, but today they were so generous in sharing what it means to them to be Black in Canada and why Black History Month still matters. Linking Black oppression and gender-based violence, naming specific changes needed, and offering concrete books and thinkers to follow, this conversation is one that you'll want to add to your podcast list this month. As always, if you have any feedback, please do reach out to education@anovafuture.org or connect with us via our socials. Give a listen. So my guests today include Ro, she, they, who is a PhD student in musicology at Western studying popular music inequity. They were born and raised on the island of Mauritius, a small island off the coast of South Africa. Ro is actually stepping in for my parental leave as manager of prevention, education, and research at Anova, so you'll be hearing from them, I'm sure. Vida, she, her, is our manager of residential programs and services at Anova's Clark Road Shelter. Of African descent, specifically from Ghana, she graduated from Sheridan College, the University of Windsor, and McMaster University. Originally from California, Jayshin is a recent PhD graduate in music education, studying ways everyday sounds shape our understanding about self in relation to others and the world. His work in creative music pedagogies via group improvisation and collaborative composition intersects with the fields of, this is a big one here, archaeoacoustics, sound studies, and sensuous scholarship, delineating how everyday sounds are both personal, social, political aspects of being and knowing the world, and offering ways of amplifying, sometimes silenced, voices. This is quite the panel. Let's get into it. We have quite the panel of folks with us today. I'm really excited. Not only do we not get to do a lot of group conversations on the podcast, but I'm really excited to learn about the diversity of your experiences under the big banner of what it means to be Black. So let's get ourselves rolling here. I want to know a bit about you and why Black History Month is important to you, sort of why you showed up for this conversation and all of its complexity. So I'm going to hand that over to Ro to get us going.
Hi, I am Ro. I am currently a student at Western University. I'm doing my PhD in musicology. I am originally from a tiny little island called Mauritius, which is off the coast of South Africa. That's where I was born and raised. And I moved to Canada when I was about 11. And so why Black History Month is important to me, I think for me, it's a month to introspectively look at my identity and how that gets reflected into the world. And it's how others see me and how I see myself and get to really have those nuanced conversation. That's what that means to me. And it's also an opportunity to talk about the diversity of experience to me, what it means to be Black, what it looks like to be Black, what it feels like culturally, what does that mean? Socially, what does that mean? I think it's a time of introspection for me personally.
Thank you. Vida, you want to jump on that one?
Okay, so my name is Vida Echampo. I'm an African descent, specifically from Ghana. I graduated from Sheridan College in the social service field, University of Windsor, also the BSW field, and McMaster University. And I'm currently an employee of Anova, Future Without Violence. So to me, what Black History Month means to me is Black liberation, to get closer to my roots by acknowledging and emphasizing the pioneers who came before us. It means to reflect on our past, present, future as a collective and carry on the work that my ancestors have started in terms of fighting against injustices. It means to continue my work in dismantling the oppressive systems mounted in our society and in our field of social work. Yeah, that's what it means to me.
I appreciate how you sort of wove the personal and also the professional, sort of wanting to dismantle the harms within the systems that you work within as part of this month. So thank you. And last but not least, Jason.
Thank you, Annalise. My name is Jason, and I'm a transplant from California here to Canada, where I came to pursue my PhD in music education. And I appreciate the introspective parts of Black History Month, as Roe pointed out, and as Vida pointed out, also the historical and futuristic part of Black History Month. And for me personally, it also is a chance to connect across centuries, connect across stories. Recently, just yesterday, Rhiannon Giddens posted, and it looks like she's going to be posting every day, stories of people that are important to her, Black persons through history that have affected how she thinks musically, how she forms, how she, for example, her recent opera, Omar, which looks at the first Muslim African slave on North American soil and had its premiere at the Met. But these types of months, they also carry for me a bit of, I'm ambivalent about them, because then they become months and they become, a day for this or a month for that. And in the collective imagination of human people, sometimes that can seem to suffice, particularly for those that are not Black, particularly for those, and even some of that are Black. So I always think of these months and these awareness type days with a little bit of trepidation as well, because once the 30th comes or the 31st or the 24 hours is over, then what is always a question for me. And it's the then what that I think these kinds of conversations are important to have.
I want to take you up on the then what. So what, what are the things that are the then what for us? Other than sort of being introspective, other than sort of calling attention to the diversity of lived experience under the rubric of Blackness in Canada, which you all have brought, and there's so much that I want to dive within each of those sort of lineages and storylines. But what can we do as the then what to this month beyond just sort of a beautiful poster and a nice color scheme that we put on our socials? Not to sort of put that right back into your court, Jason, but I'm going to do that.
Sure, of course, yeah. The then what is something that, haunts me every day because in everything that we do, I think it's important to think about the implications of what we do. And so for me, when I think of the then what, I think of the daily dismantling, sort of what Vida was talking about. And in this daily dismantling of systemic injustices, particularly now. I mean, we have a month, and yet just last week, in the United States, there's another shooting of a Black person by Black police officers, and which really shows the intrinsic hatred that is bred in the colonialist society that we live in. And I think that the then what is to consistently bring attention to that. However, what we're finding is we're finding a wall in certain places, for example, Florida and Governor DeSantis and what he is proposing for education. So I think the then what is to call attention to these things in our classrooms and our workspaces. If we are inclined to join up with certain groups or to protest in ways that feel good for us, that feel meaningful for us, then those are ways to do it. For myself, I being, coming from music, I find that the classroom space musically is a place to do it, specifically by asking students to tune into what they hear in their world, what they hear, not just music, but everyday sounds. Because in those everyday sounds, there's going to be all kinds of human conflict as it relates to systemic injustice. And if we can have a little bit more awareness and sonic sensibility about what we hear in the world, then there's an opportunity to open up consciousness in a way that can provide some sort of action. So it's not so these months and these days bring reflection, but it's the consciousness of action that is the then what, and how to marry the action reflection to then act again and react and respond really to the world and the issues that we have in it. I think that answers for me a little bit of the then what.
I have to agree with that as well. I think part of the sonic sensibility, I think both of us coming from music as well, but I think historically as well, for me, it's about oral histories. It's giving a chance to hear those stories that were not put in writing. Because again, of the type of societies we live in and of who holds the power to tell history, I think we have forgotten the value of our history. And sometimes it's a going back to that. It's sharing those histories that our ancestors passed down, but that were never written in textbooks. And that doesn't make them any less valid. So oral history is, I think, another way that I want to hear those stories.
And just to add on to what my folks just, said, representation is very, very vital. And, as a person of color, you hope with Black Lives Matters that strike global protests, and also the actions that we see day in day, some of us do experience, we will believe that there has been enough awareness, but a lot still need to be done. A lot still need to be done.
It's definitely not something that's sort of in the past in terms of we've had an achievement moment. And I think the events of the past week, while American, reverberate in sort of really specific ways beyond that. I think what's really exciting about a group conversation is that we all know, and we could all sort of preach to this, that no one experience can represent a full group. So our stories and our experiences are always helpful in sort of better understanding larger issues, but we're not trying to even purport that the three of you represent what it means to be Black in Canada. However, that's exactly what I want to ask you. From your lens and your vantage point, what has it been like to be Black in Canada in the current status of what that is? Who wants to tackle that first? Vaida?
So, it means a lot. It means you have to continuously keep proving yourself that you do belong in certain spaces. It means continuously proving yourself that you do deserve certain resources and services that are basically that everyone else deserves. It means being a mother, you have to constantly checking in the fear that you will not be able to protect, especially your male child, as soon as they step out of your door. It means continuously reinforcing to your daughters that they do they are worth it. It doesn't matter the color of their skin. They are more beyond the color of their skin. It means the texture of their hair doesn't represent who they are.
You're bringing forward something so personal in your own parenting. And can you, if you're comfortable, share a little bit more, like what have those struggles been like? I understand you have a couple daughters and a son. Mm-hmm. What does it mean to be a Black young man versus Black young women, and how are you navigating that as a mother?
So as a Black person, the color of your skin puts you at higher risk, but in terms of our male children, it's even at a greater risk than. So obviously we would have conversation with them at a certain age, depending where you live. But it's not just one conversation and that's the end. It's continuously, because we want to be able to protect our sons from systems and people who were supposed to protect us. But unfortunately, in the South, as a Black woman, that doesn't happen often. So as soon as your son reaches certain age, you have to constantly keep telling him, that you have to present yourself a certain way. That it will even get to a point if you want to drive, and let's say you work so hard to save money and want to reward yourself by buying maybe a car that your other peers will be able to buy, like a tinted car, you won't be able to do that because that put you at risk. It means constantly checking in, where are you, when are you coming home, are you safe, which is overwhelming, and it gets tiresome for parents as well as children.
There's a constant like ticking in your mind, it sounds like, of that constant worry. And that, I know, Jason, you sort of said earlier about the internalized oppression, let's say, of sort of Black police officers, but what does that mean as a mother and the internalization of that constant risk navigating? Thank you for sharing that. Rower Jason, what does it mean for you folks in your experiences of being Black in Canada?
You know, I gave this question a lot of thought. I gave this podcast a lot of thought. I think for me, it's about dealing with the daily microaggressions that I still have to face, to deal with the questions of where are you really from, to deal with, like Vida said, the imposter syndrome of even if you do achieve something great, that people will turn around and say, well, you know, it's the minority card that you got there because there were certain things at play, that it wasn't because of your hard work, that it was, you know, this specific scholarship was designed specifically for this, that type of group of people or whatever the case may be, that it wasn't what you achieved that mattered. It was something else. But I think it's also dealing with boxes, is being put in boxes, which I hate. Well, I've had this conversation numerous times, but you know, my experiences, where I'm from and where I've lived throughout the years, I don't choose to identify as anything else other than myself. And so sometimes those surveys that ask you to self-identify your ethnicity give me a lot of anxiety because I'm not sure what they're asking of me, right? There's a difference here between, for me, identity, ethnicity, and culture. And I'm never really sure what box they want me to be put into. And so that's what that means for me in Canada. It's facing those questions.
You know, and I think I'm guilty of being the boxer, in that when we were early in sort of getting to know each other a little bit, and for folks, I mean, it's a podcast, so they can't see you, but you can get read in different ways based on sort of the tone and color of your skin. So I think people impose their own interpretation, as did I, onto you and onto your body. So, you know, are you the brown ticky box? Are you the Black ticky box? Nothing's quite working right in that space. And so, of course, that leads you to have a complicated relationship with the very notion of boxes.
Yes. And it's also, funnily enough, I related the most to this, or this came to popularity the most when Kamala Harris became the first vice president, who is biracial. And the slew of articles of people asking, is she Black? Is she South Asian? And it's to me and to people who are like me, perhaps more specifically who are from Mauritius, we're looking at this saying, why are people questioning this? This is such a normal, regular thing. But there was such a confusion in the general population to know that she must be one of these. She cannot be both. She must be one. And I think that's what I struggle with, is that I can be a multitude of things, but people want you to tick one box. You have to be just the one, and you cannot be anything else. And that's hard, and that's heavy.
Asian?
Yeah, that really resonates with me and makes me think about, you know, where I grew up in South Central Los Angeles. So South Central Los Angeles, a lot of people, when I say that, they're like, oh, cool. And I always have to say to them, no, it really wasn't. It was horrible. I mean, you have drive-by shootings, you have crack cocaine, you've got, you know, prostitutes you've got pimps that are burning cats in the alley where I lived. You've got all this stuff growing up. Police, you know, everyday presence in the neighborhood. My mom, who is Mexican, walking me to school for elementary school just so that I would avoid confrontation with the being jumped into a gang. Yet you look at me, and I know we're on a podcast, you can't see me, but because of this biracial aspect of myself, my dad was African-American from Texas, grew up in the South, and was born in 1930s. So he grew up in, you know, a very Jim Crow-ish sort of South, and then meets my mom in Los Angeles, who is Mexican with roots from Oaxaca. So you get this mix of me in the middle of South Central Los Angeles. And that is something that sort of, you know, has always been a part of my explanation, sort of like my name, Jason. You know, they always have to explain my name and tend to always have to, if the conversation goes deeper with people, explain a little bit about my my background. So when I think of this, I think of, you know, when I came to Canada specifically, what came with me were notions that, oh, it's really the United States that is the racist pig, not the not Canada. And yet, you know, there is racism here. My first exposure to it was really at the border, coming through the border and sort of seeing how I was, you know, looked at and treated, specifically the Windsor border more recently. But I came in with notions that Canada was a different place and didn't have these issues, and quickly learned that, you know, it, particularly in a university setting, that those issues are there. They're built into the system. And so in my experience in Canada, in the institution that I've been studying at, I noticed that whenever these surveys came out for particularly the equity, diversity, inclusion that all these universities are talking about doing, when this survey came out, I did not participate in those surveys. I did not feel comfortable participating in those surveys because I hold the belief that these kinds of institutions, whether in Canada or any Western institution, cannot decolonize until they decapitalize, until they realize that colonization is integrated into capitalism and that slavery was a result of capitalistic ideas. So I see these motions toward decolonization and equity, diversity, inclusion, indigenization, and all of these things as problematic when they don't admit the tie into capitalism. And so I found a sense of whenever I would see these emails come across my screen of like, you have 3 days to participate. You have a week to participate. Your voice matters. I'm like, no, it doesn't, because my voice means nothing to you at the end of the day, because it's a dollar sign for an institution. And so I think that in my experience in Canada, I've seen less racism than I did in the United States. I see a little bit more of an openness to having conversations about, you know, topics that are related to race and police brutality. What was her name? She wrote a one. I got to hear her speak at Western. Robin Maynard, Policing Black Lives. She gave a talk early on, when I first got to Western, about a book that she had just published. And I didn't even, you know, you kind of know that, okay, these things are, racism is certainly something that's all over the world, but in the US, there's this idea that Canada is different. And it is different. It's a different type of way of enacting. But I can say that, you know, my experience here has been a little more open to having these conversations than in the States. Yeah.
Okay, I don't even know where to start because there's so much of what you just said that could be expanded on. I do, yeah, I think it's really interesting the position you sit in where you do have that in like built-in comparator, which as Canadians, conversely, we always like to point to the US as being worse. So you problematize that in a different way too. But we could do a whole podcast on the integration of EDI efforts with capitalism. And I want to go there, but I don't know that we have the time in this one to do that work. Very fair point. I do want to do some integration work, though, between racism, Blackness, and gender-based violence, because of where we're situated at ANOVA particularly. And so I know on our socials, sort of last week specifically, but in different moments and times, we've really tried to connect how gender-based violence isn't just this thing that happens in a vacuum, that all of the other isms and all of the other structures are part of why it happens and to whom it happens. But I wonder if, and Vida, I am going to put you on the spot first, given that you're right in that system, have those things been linked for you in your own experience or in some of the experiences that you've seen professionally with some of the survivors that you've worked with, sort of gender-based violence and the Black lived experience of oppression?
So as I mentioned earlier on, representation do matter. We have women come through our doors that sometimes they are hoping to see somebody that looks like them, that because of certain barriers like culture, tradition, that the people have some form of understanding and will be able to, you know, support them. But unfortunately, we don't have that representation in those spaces. So it makes it difficult for women to open up in terms of even accessing resources, because we already, due to the color of our skin, the perception is already formed about us, right? But I keep saying that all the time, that we cannot, in terms of women experiencing the same situation, we cannot categorize women into the same boxes, because somebody's experiences and also all the barriers that are associated with will be different. We have, let's say, predominantly white woman who experience domestic violence, but some barriers are lenient for her to be able to open up and really express her experience and attain services that they need to transition. But in terms of Black women, we have to look at cultural barriers, which I don't think we are doing much enough in that area. So it's always put Black women on disadvantage in terms of accessing resources.
And before I sort of turn it to you, Ro or Jason, to sort of engage in a way that makes sense, but I do think there's a bit of a miss. For those of us who sit in places of privilege, there is a bit of a sense that, you know, to have somebody who looks like you not deeply understanding why that is not just a nice to have, because we walk through the world and the world looks like me. And so the, you know, the tangible sense, as I've sort of learned in different moments, is that it's not just a nice to have. It creates a sense of being understood and not having to fully explain everything in addition to the moment of trauma that I'm actually coming to you with, right? And so that's sort of a re-traumatizing if I have to do all of that extra emotional labor to explain the nuance of something about my identity. There's also a sense that I've sort of heard from folks that it increases safety, that I have a sense of being held by you and sort of knowing who I am in the world and what I've experienced, but also therefore that feels safer. And when, again, we're talking about gender-based violence, like that is so integral to supporting healing and supporting working through trauma. So it's not a nice to have. It is really integral to the actual mission of what, you know, you and staff and others do in our shelters and our counseling spaces. So we do need to prioritize, as sort of, in some ways, as mundane as it sounds, having diversity embedded into the system. Ro, Jason.
Yeah, I think I completely agree with that. And I think I relate to that as well. I think there is something about seeing somebody who has the same shared life experiences as you, who looks the same as you, and so on and so forth. There is a certain preamble that you will not have to do when you are meeting that person. If I am meeting another, you know, queer woman of color, I know I will not get asked a question, where are you really from? I will not get questioned about my race, my ethnicity, my sexuality. I know that I won't have to go through those. And there is an emotional safety in that. There's comfort in that. There's something peaceful about that almost for me. There's something that, okay, I can approach this person and get to the point, so to speak. I can ask them for help and know that my help will not be invalidated by the multitude of questions that somebody else may have asked me. And so I completely agree.
I really like how Vida, you know, talked about representation and how representation matters. And you know, Annalise, when you talked about diversity as something that we need to embed in the system. However, I'll push back on that a little bit, just looking at the events of last week, because while diversity embedded in the system is something that's important, when the system is as corrupt as many institutions are, it doesn't really matter. To take Michael Jackson, if you're black or white, it doesn't matter who is there if they have bought in to the institutional and systemic deficiencies that are present, as for example in police and special units or elite units, as we're hearing about this week. Those were all black men that beat, you know, and killed Tyree. So I think that while it's important to, and that I believe is gender-based violence as well, because it's male on male, there's the machoistic aspect of police. And there's the, the sense when you watch this video of the vulnerability of Tyree, and there's the, you know, the comments that some of the, you know, police officers made, saying, oh yeah, we want to stomp him, you know, we want to, you know, get him. That's all part of a macho and very patriarchal and very what we hear is toxic masculinity. So I think that while representation is important, it's equally important to be mindful that that doesn't necessarily, you know, erase. What will erase is the structure being dismantled, and always having that as a focus of, in whatever way is possible, to dismantle, to disrupt, and to dismantle the system that causes this. Because whether gender, race, socioeconomic status, whatever the labels that society, that systems put on people, it's always the system that needs to be looked at for where it is problematic. And I think that that's where the intersectionality for me comes, is at the systemic level, and for all of us who are interested in these types of dismantling ways and in whatever ways that we're able to do it, and by any means that we're able to do that.
I just want to add, so in terms of, you know, recent incident that happened, the five police officers, yes, they were Black, but we also have to understand that once we are wearing those uniforms, right, that the power comes into play. So some folks will say the system is broken. The system is not broken. The system is built, is structured the way that it's intended to work and it's achieving its purpose. So, and yet again, I did mention earlier on that most of us have these systems, these people in position of power, their aim was to protect us, right? But we've noticed that time and time over and over, they are the same systems that kept, you know, harming us, hurting us. So no matter what, how hard we work through healing, some of us will continuously walk with a limp in our legs the rest of our life. So it's about facing the fact that, no, the system is set up the way that it's supposed to work. So how do we then dismantle that systems?
So much brilliance in this conversation. Thank you. I want to sort of just reflect that, Jason, thank you for expanding the definition of gender-based violence to include male-on-male brutality as targeted because of masculinity. I think that often gets missed in that part of the conversation. So thank you. And also for really, you called it pushback, the yes and of really representation matters. But, and I think there's some deep work within each system because we're talking about the system and the is a bit complicated because there are of course multiple systems. And so we've highlighted post-secondary, we've highlighted police, but the gender-based violence sector is its own system. And so within that space, how does power operate? How does whiteness operate? That's a whole other space to be reflective on. I asked you to come prepared to provide us some further content. And so be that a book, a podcast, a thinker, something you would point our listeners to learn more, or even perhaps something that's really meant a lot to you more personally in your own sort of growth and unpacking. I'm wondering if I can call on you to share. Ro?
Yes, absolutely. I was just pulling my list, actually, and I will try not to go through all of it. I've only picked a first few. The first one, of course, is related to the studies that I do, which is music. But this is a wonderful book by Guthrie Ramsey called Who Hears Here on Black Music Past and Present. And it's an absolutely beautiful book that I highly recommend. The other one would hail from a Mauritian author, a book by Kama Lamacrel, and it's called Zom Fam. Absolutely beautiful book. It's poetic in itself, and I highly recommend it. It dwells in...
Can you just spell that, given that we are absolutely. An audio space? Thank you.
Absolutely. So the last one is Zom Fam, so Zom-FAM. By Kama Lamacrel. So Kama is K-A-M-A, La is L-A, and Macrel is M-A-C-K-E-R-E-L. Highly recommend that book. And finally, I will finish with a book that I think just everybody should read in general, and that is Bell Hooks, All About Love. Everybody should read that book. It doesn't matter what your interests are. It should be a required textbook everywhere. So those are my two recommendations.
And it's also highly accessible as a read. So go forth. Jason?
Yeah, I have to pick up on the bell hooks because that was one of my lists. But Teaching to Transgress is the one that I find I always go back to because it really goes to this idea of consciousness or the Freirean conscientiation, the action, reflection, the cyclical aspect of what it means to be in the world. So that certainly is one that I go back to regularly, as well as Baldwin. I mean, I always go back to Fire Next Time. That's a regular read or listen of mine, because Baldwin has a way with, you know, just timeless, the things that he is saying. And more recently, I have been reading the book. In fact, I brought it here because there was a quote I wanted to share, but it's Black Mutiny, and it's about Amistad. And this is by William Owens. Black Mutiny, the revolt on the schooner Amistad. For those unfamiliar with it, it's a really great history of part of U.S. history involving two presidents, that would be John Adams and Martin Van Buren. John Adams, who was sitting in the court at the time. But what it is, and the reason I felt it was important to this conversation, is because this idea of Black History Month, this idea of awareness, for me is about Black mutiny. It's really about resistance, and resisting the norms, resisting the systems that say, that discount voices and that discount others. But one quote in here that's early on that I appreciate is, it says, once the question of rights has been established, and equality begins to emerge as a basic assumption, the struggle over political and economic power can take place in an impartial arena. And really, that crosses gender, race, socioeconomic. When I can see you, when I can hear you, when I can feel you as another consciousness on this planet, as a being, when I can do that, when that heart space is open to that, then there is an opportunity and a space to actually have conversations about why it is that, you know, inequalities exist. And I think that that's something that's always should be at the forefront of any sort of historical month or awareness day, is, can I feel you as a human? And if I can do that, then there's a slight chance we can, you know, move to the next part, which is like, well, pay me equally, treat me fairly. Don't assume things about me based upon a stereotype that you that you and your system have created that I should fall into, so that I can be categorically correct in your eyes. See me as the human I am in front of you, and feel me as that way.
So powerful. Vaida.
Okay, with me, books that I will recommend is written by Angela Yvonne Davis. She's an American political activist and has written books about race, gender, feminist. Three books that really, it gave me the opportunity to dive in and deep and, you know, reflect on myself and try to work on healing, right, from my surroundings and also within. Because as I said, no matter even all the hard work that we will do through healing, there is still some of us that will walk with a limp in like the rest of our life. So the books are Freedom is a Constant Struggle. And then the other one is The Meaning of Freedom and Other Difficult Dialogues and U.S. Prison System. I did like a quote that one of my policy professor used to say all the time, that people, we prejudge, people are always like blaming the victim, right? But not, let's forget that the personal is political.
What a line to end on. Thank you. Thank you all three for the generosity brought to the conversation, both sort of bringing your full selves, your own sort of personal identities. I also feel like I got glimmers of new knowledge around music that is just new for me because we're overrepresented from our music experts here, which was a lovely add-on. So thank you all three for showing up into this conversation. It was a pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
And Elise.
Piece by Piece is a production of ANOVA, A Future Without Violence. ANOVA is on social media, and you can learn more about Piece by Piece and ANOVA at www.anovafuture.org. A reminder that if you need to talk, please call our 24-hour crisis and support line at 1-800-265-1576. Our sexual assault counselors are available for virtual appointments, and our shelters are open. We're here for you. A special thank you to Naji Naimzadeh for technical production, Emma Richard for visual content creation, and music for this podcast is from the album Sweet and Joyful by Crowander, the track Humming. Music access, downloaded, and used under Creative Commons license via freemusicarchive.org. See you next time.